Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. May I take this opportunity on behalf of the London School of Economics to welcome you all to this lecture. And I'm going to ask David Wardrop, who is the chair of the United Nations Association Westminster, to introduce our speaker.
Professor Greenwood, LSE, thank you very much for inviting us to have the second Ruth Steinkraus Cohen International Law Lecture here in the Old Theatre. Ruth Steinkraus Cohen, who was she? She was a great Connecticut lady, a supporter of the United Nations, and Eleanor Roosevelt, a friend of hers, said, "Ruth, you're not doing enough." And she was known in Connecticut as one of these people who brings people together. In a time when many think that society here is fragmenting, we're all at the end of our mobile phones texting rather than talking, she was one of those people who was a sort of a counterforce. And she did that absolutely within the context of the United Nations, one of her great passions. She recognized in the UN diplomatic community, the diplomats, their children, their wives, and those UN staff who were new to New York, that they were actually separate from the host community. And she set up host hospitality committees in the New York and Connecticut areas for just those diplomats. And in her town of Westport, about an hour north of the city, she would have in June, to mark the signing of the UN Charter, June Day, and bring all these diplomats and their families up there. And across the Saugerkut Bridge, there in Westport, she would put all the flags of the United Nations. The rather rightist council would take them all down again halfway through the afternoon, but for 40 years, she did just that. And in fact, 50,000 UN diplomats, families, and staff enjoyed her hospitality. That's a lot of people. And the members of the diplomatic community here in this room, you are very welcome. And I'm sure either if you have not enjoyed her hospitality, others did. She was awarded in 2000, she was one of just 32 Americans awarded the prize for as a volunteer of the millennium. 32. It was a very visionary concept that the USA had in the year 2000. I wish we had had one similar. But in 1982, she, bringing people together again, she twinned the United Nations Association in Connecticut with our own in Westminster. And she died a couple of years ago, and still her calendar of peace is hung up on school walls around the world, and the bridge that she hung those flags up on is now named after her. How should we remember, we thought? The answer was her second great passion, which was Hugo Grotius. Ruth found inspiration in his works. And this great 16th century Dutch statesman, regarded by many as the father of international law. She founded the Connecticut Hugo Grotius Society, and frankly, I think she probably founded Hugo Grotius Societies all around the world. She never traveled without one of these busts. If you ever see one of these busts in London, you know she has been there. Restaurants, organizations, buildings, maybe even the LSE. So we set out to remember Ruth by linking the United Nations and its work in the centrality of the creation of international law and Hugo Grotius. In 2003, last year, I asked Hans Corell, the UN Legal Counsel, to give the inaugural address, and he did, developing the rule of law among nations, a challenge to the UN. You see the little logo, una-uk.org, you will find his inaugural address. Now, a year ago, remember, under the shadow of the Iraq War, debate on that war was much discussed, as was the relevance of the United Nations itself. So we in the UN Association wanted to anchor in the British mind that the UN was still important, and that's why we got the top legal man to speak here. And we wanted him to speak in somewhere which was the United Nations. As you know, the only UN agency in London is the International Maritime Organization up the river, and that was where he spoke. The event was chaired by Judge Rosalind Higgins, of the International Court of Justice. She first spoke to us as long ago in 1965 about the UN forces and international peace. And in 1983, as a professor of international law here at the LSE, she spoke to us again on Hugo Grotius and the UN Charter. So things come round. Hans Corell last year spoke about the rule of law. And this year we wanted to discuss its application, the exercise of justice. I was drawn to Peter Hansen's address to a mixed audience in East Jerusalem on 4th of January this year, titled An End to Occupation, A Just Peace in Israel-Palestine Towards an Active International Network. In that speech, I counted the word justice 16 times. I thought this must be the right chap. We asked him to give the lecture. He agreed. Peter Hansen is not new to us in UNA Westminster, but because we have followed his career at the UN over many years. And being a senior UN diplomat is not just sitting in the 38th floor of the UN building. 10 years ago, pretty well to the very day, it was he who, while fighting raged in and around Kigali, led the interagency humanitarian team to the city of Kigali. UNAMIR forces were being pulled out, and he flew in on the empty returning planes. The airport was itself part of the battle zone. His efforts to secure the WFP food stocks were blocked by hostile fire. The city was deserted except for military and others terrorizing the population. The only way to move around was by armored car. Bodies were littered all around. Was there any one scene that you will never forget? He was asked in October 1994 by the UN Chronicle magazine. The demonstrations in Goma at that time directed against the refugees. Roadblocks were being set up by the demonstrators, and the most available material to build the roadblocks were the corpses, which were being stacked across the road to hinder traffic. In this year, we've marked the 10th anniversary of that terrible chapter in our history. What went wrong and what went right? And things do go wrong in the UN. On the 30th of June, in a couple of months' time, in St. Margaret's Westminster, we will, in the association, mark the loss of UN staff in Baghdad, led by Sergio Vieira de Mello. In 1995, a year after Rwanda, Peter Hansen agreed to meet us here in UNA Westminster in the House of Commons. The horror of the previous year was now clearer, but like a supporters' club, questioning the tactics of the manager, we gave him a rough time. The role of a senior UN person is not easy, and Peter Hansen has never sought the easy route. In 1996, he was appointed Commissioner General of UNWA. That's not an easy route. A word, Mr. Chairman, about UNA. I've mentioned our website, thatisit.org. And we have a branch here in the LSE. Please think about joining it. We've got exciting plans here, too. On the 2nd of June, we'll be marking the very first International Day of UN Peacekeepers anywhere, a one-day conference bringing in experts from around the world. If you can't make the meeting, join us at the Cenotaph at 1 o'clock on Wednesday, 2nd of June, when representatives from the 105 countries who have lost UN peacekeepers, their sons and daughters, representing us too, will be laying wreaths. Never before so many at one particular time. Finally, the UN, as we know, is more than just the Security Council and the distant vision of those who emerged from the last war, a vision perhaps clearer than ours is of it today. But it was she, Ruth, was very clear about it. But we know too that the UN is not we the peoples, but we the governments. It's crazy, some say to us, to support an organization which is somebody else's anyway. And we, the governments, have no duty, no responsibility to actually tell us, we the peoples, what has been happening in the UN or what they've done. And to my knowledge, not a single one of the 190 governments in the world actually does that. So don't walk away from us, the UNA. Don't walk away from the UN. Some of us here in this room will be going after this meeting to the Aurora restaurant in Catherine Street, just beyond, I think it's Fame, but I'm sure you know, where a special priced meal has been put on. So if you want to slam the UN, slam it in good company and enjoy. There are membership forms outside. We need new members. Members of the LSE in the branch there, and members too in Westminster, your local branch. That is why Grotius's bust is here. And that is why we've invited Peter Hansen. So pleased we are to speak. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. I'm indeed honored to have been invited to deliver the second annual Steinkraus Rose Cohen International Law Lecture, all the more so since I and my family have been recipient of her hospitality and her organization of it in New York. I would also like to extend my appreciation to the United Nations Association of Westminster, the Bar Council, and the Law Department of the London School of Economics for taking the initiative to co-sponsor and host this event. I would also like to pay tribute, even if I can't do it as eloquently as was just done, to the memory of the woman in whose name it was organized, Ruth Steinkraus Cohen's untiring support of the United Nations and her interest in and advocacy for continued development of public international law. It serves as an excellent example to common people who aspire to shape a better and more just world, one that is rooted in the fundamental equality of all individuals and peoples, in universal human rights, and in the rule of law. The inaugural international law lecture delivered by my former colleague Hans Corell, he just retired a few months ago, the legal counsel of the UN, and he set out, I believe very well, the importance of public international law from the time of Grotius to the present, and the centrality of the United Nations in its development in the post-1945 era. In contrast to the more theoretical reflections shared by Mr. Corell last year, I have today been asked as a humanitarian practitioner to try to discuss the role and application of public international law in the field, as they say, particularly as it refers to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the Palestine refugee problem itself, almost as old as the United Nations. As you're surely aware, the United Nations has played a central role in the conflict over Israel-Palestine from the General Assembly's recommendation to partition Palestine in Resolution 181 of November 1947 to its current involvement in efforts to achieve peace through the roadmap as a member of the International Quartet. Since 1950, and in response to the creation of the Palestine refugee problem during the war of 1948, UNRWA has provided essential education, health, relief and social services, economic assistance, microcredit, etc., etc., to Palestine refugees, now more than 4 million of them, running on 4.2 million registered with UNRWA within our five areas of operations in the Middle East, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, Gaza, and the West Bank. Notwithstanding the complex legal and political issues UNRWA has had to deal with in its area of operations, many of which I shall today discuss, the role of law in the organization's operating environment is no different than it is at the municipal level. To serve as a normative force in governing relations between actors, particularly those of unequal strength, to prescribe rules by which all subjects shall be bound so as to ensure a minimum degree of predictability, fairness, and justice. I have elsewhere discussed the subject of justice and the Palestine refugee problem. I didn't know I mentioned it 16 times, but I trust your count. I have, then let me only say that in my opinion, in the absence of a just solution to their plight, one that is fair, equitable, and in keeping with relevant principles of public international law, a durable solution to the conflict in Israel-Palestine will continue to elude us. Before I delve into the topic of the role of international law in UNRWA's operational environment from a humanitarian perspective, it is important to discuss the role of international law with respect to the Palestine refugee problem. Many of you will be familiar with the well-established legal maxim, ubi jus, ibi remedium, that is Latin pronounced in Danish, I'm sorry about that. In plain terms, this maxim embodies the principle that for the law to matter, there must always be an accessible forum in which complaints against violations of the law may be made, and more importantly, effective mechanisms for the delivery of appropriate remedies may be sought. In the absence of law enforcement, it has been argued that the law is not worth the paper it is written on. While international law lacks the range of enforcement mechanisms available at the municipal level, adherence to international law prescriptions is usually ensured through other mechanisms, including moral suasion, good faith, and comity. In rare cases, the international community has ensured adherence to principles of international law through the UN Security Council, including under the provisions of Chapter 7 of the Charter, when the issue has been considered a threat to international peace and security. But leaving aside these rare occasions, as noted by Hans Corell in last year's address, most international law, and I quote him, is faithfully applied on a daily basis throughout the world, touching upon almost all activities of human beings that one can think of, from trade to human rights and from the environment to organized crime. Having said that, there have been some cases in which the fair and equitable application of international law has been perceived as being severely wanting, to some maybe even smacking of a double standard. One such case has been that of the Palestine refugees. For over half a century, the Palestine refugees have clung to their right to return to the homes from which they were displaced in 1948, a right that was originally affirmed by the General Assembly in Resolution 194 of 10 December 1948, and which has been annually reaffirmed by the Assembly to this day. It has often struck me in the Middle East, talking to young people and children, that they can cite more out of Resolution 194 than any Danish equivalent age children I know can cite from the Danish constitution. Notwithstanding the centrality of their plight to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the concrete and practical support of the Security Council for a durable solution to the Palestine refugee problem has never existed beyond its affirmation in Resolution 242 of 1967 of the necessity of achieving a just settlement of the refugee problem, and its more recent affirmation in Resolution 1515 of 19 November 2003 of the need for the parties to conclude a peace agreement through the roadmap, including, and I quote, an agreed, just, fair, and a new adjective now, and realistic solution to the refugee problem. In contrast to this, the Security Council has unequivocally and many a time under Chapter 7 of the Charter supported the rights of refugees in other conflict zones to exercise their right to return to their homes, particularly in Kosovo, East Timor, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Namibia, to name but a few. Rightly or wrongly, the Palestine refugees view this difference in approach as a double standard in the application of international law, and many around the world share this view. This perception of a double standard must end if international law is to retain its meaning and relevance in the Middle East as a whole. I shall now turn to a discussion of the various branches of international law that have a role and impact on UNRWA's operational environment from a humanitarian point of view. It goes without saying that the central legal foundation upon which the agency's work is based is the Charter of the United Nations, Article 1 of which stipulates that the purpose of the UN is to bring about an adjustment or settlement of international disputes through, and I quote again, peaceful means and in conformity with principles of international of justice and international law. As a humanitarian organization, UNRWA's role is to help assist the Palestinian refugees until such a peaceful settlement to the Israel-Palestinian dispute can be concluded between the parties to the conflict, all of whom ought to act in accordance with the principles of justice and international law in the course of dealing with each other and with the agency. Another important instrument of UN law that impacts the operational environment of the agency is the 1946 Convention on the Privileges and Immunities of the United Nations. Based on the principles set out in Articles 104 and 105 of the UN Charter, the Convention provides that the UN and its duly appointed representatives shall enjoy in the territory of each of its member states such privileges and immunities as are necessary for the fulfillment of their purposes and for the independent exercise of their functions. Specifically, it provides that the property and assets of the UN, wherever located and by whomsoever held, shall be immune from search, requisition, confiscation, expropriation, and other forms of interference. It further provides that UN assets, income, and other property shall be exempt from all direct taxes, and that its imports and exports for official purposes shall be exempt from customs duties and prohibitions and restrictions. And importantly, it stipulates that officials of the United Nations shall be immune from legal process in respect of all acts performed by them in their official capacity in relation to each of the states in which UNRWA operates. And this is not just in relation to Israel. The agency has heavily relied on the 1946 Convention to assist it in fulfilling its mandate. This has been particularly so with respect to its operations in the occupied territories over the course of the current Intifada, where Israel has imposed a number of measures that have directly impinged on the movement of UNRWA staff and goods in violation of the agency's privileges and immunities. The most recent of such violations forced the agency to suspend its emergency food distribution program in the Gaza Strip in early April as a result of restrictions imposed by the Israeli authorities as the sole commercial entry point for the strip, the Karni crossing. The agency regularly makes representations to the Israeli authorities based in part on the 1946 Convention, but we have other instruments and direct agreements too, but I make this reference particularly to the Convention. In the case of the emergency food distribution program, many such representations probably helped in the final analysis in getting the restrictions imposed by Israel lifted, which facilitated the agency decision to recommence the program in late April. But never had they been lifted before new restrictions were introduced that again posed the problem to us: can we go along much further under these circumstances? In addition, there remains a blanket prohibition on marked UNRWA trucks moving in and out of the Gaza Strip, a container transit fee at Karni crossing, and a requirement that all goods and containers be unloaded from one truck and reloaded to another truck at the crossing. Furthermore, during the period 1st July to 30 June, 1st July 2002 to 30 June 2003, that is over a 1 year period, there were some 1,161 major incidents involving denial of entry or delay of UNRWA staff and vehicles at Israeli military checkpoints in the West Bank, involving some 5,078 UNRWA employees, resulting in 5,959 lost work hours, equivalent to 1,061 working days. In some instances, staff members' UNRWA identification cards were confiscated, and occasionally summonses were issued to staff members instructing them to appear for questioning. On a number of occasions, staff members waiting at checkpoints were abused, physically assaulted, and even fired upon by IDF troops. During the same period, there were many incursions by the Israeli Defense Forces into UNRWA installations in the West Bank in contravention of Israel's obligations under the 1946 Convention. One such example occurred on the 25th of September 2002, when an IDF special unit made an incursion into UNRWA's Qalqilya hospital, where they threatened staff and patients at gunpoint, beat five members of the hospital staff, including a female administrator and a health official who had arrived at the scene to treat the wounded, and then arrested three other agency staff members, while during the process using several staff members as human shields for forcible entry. On another occasion, on 2nd April 2003, Israeli troops forcibly entered UNRWA's Tulkarem Girls' School, used the grounds of the compound for several days as a temporary detention center for male camp residents. As to staff safety and immunity, since the beginning of the current intifada in September 2002, 10 UNRWA staff members have been killed by the Israeli forces, two while on duty, and between 1st of June 2000 and today, some 130 have been arrested and or detained by Israeli authorities. Another aspect of UN law that is relied upon by the agency is the great body of resolutions that support its operations. The General Assembly created UNRWA in 1949 to, and I quote, carry out in collaboration with local governments, direct relief and works programs, and to consult with the interested Near Eastern governments concerning measures to be taken by them preparatory to the time when international assistance for relief and works project is no longer available. Resolution 302 establishing UNRWA recognized that continued assistance for the relief of Palestine refugees was necessary to prevent conditions of starvation and distress among them, and to further conditions of peace and stability, without prejudice, of course, to paragraph 11 of Resolution 194 concerning the right of refugees to return and to compensation. Since then, the agency's mandate has repeatedly been refined and shaped by other General Assembly resolutions, which have allowed it to shift its focus from reintegration efforts in its early years to human development projects throughout to this very day. Another aspect of international law that has marked our operational environment has been the various bilateral agreements we have concluded with host governments and local authorities in our area of operations. As pointed out by Sir William Dale, former General Counsel to UNRWA, the agency's status as a subsidiary organ of the General Assembly has meant that its structure and terms of reference are not as definite and may be modified by the international community without reference to any governing treaty which would otherwise serve to outline in specific language the powers, functions, and organs of the agency, as well as set out the obligations of member states in respect of it. The general language of resolutions which create and govern the activity of subsidiary organs places them in the distinctly different position of having to conclude additional agreements with the relevant authorities in order to effectively operate within their territories. These agreements, of course, establish terms of reference that are supplementary to those that exist in any governing resolution as well as in the UN Charter. Treaty-based bodies like ILO or the WHO do not have to go through the trouble of concluding such agreements, as their governing statutes may be turned in to the event of disputes between the respective organization and member states regarding the roles, rights, and duties of each. We have such agreements with each one of our host countries, with the Palestinian Authority, and a special exchange of letters that incorporates a number of the rights of the agencies and the duties of Israel vis-a-vis the agency, the so-called Comey-Michelmore agreement. Another important body of international law that we rely upon, particularly in the areas that have been occupied by foreign military forces, has been international humanitarian law. In today's context, this body of law is most relevant to agency operations in the occupied territories, where Israel's authority derives from its status as occupying power, making it bound by the 1907 Hague regulations and the 1949 Geneva Convention relative to the protection of civilian persons in the time of war, not to mention the relevant principles of customary international law as it relates to belligerent occupation. The Fourth Geneva Convention, in particular, provides for the protection of numerous rights of the civilian population, including the right to be protected against willful killing, collective punishment, torture or inhuman treatment, unlawful deportation or transfer, willful deprivation of the right to a fair trial, and extensive destruction and appropriation of property. From the standpoint of the agency's humanitarian operations, the Fourth Geneva Convention sets forth the legal obligations and duties of Israel as occupying power towards the Palestinian civilian population, including ensuring that the Palestinians have access to adequate education, health, food, shelter, and other such socioeconomic services. The Israelis, of course, have never recognized the de jure applicability of the convention to the occupied territories, arguing that they are only bound by its so-called humanitarian provisions without defining precisely which provisions it considers humanitarian. Nevertheless, guided by the General Assembly, the agency has framed its relationship with Israel with respect to its operation in the occupied territories in terms of the convention. The agency's representations to the Israeli authorities often rely in part on the convention. For instance, when its schools have been commandeered or come under fire by Israeli forces, or its staff have been physically molested or prohibited from delivering food supplies or medical assistance to Palestinian villages cordoned off by military checkpoints and settler bypass roads. By way of example, the convention provides that protected persons shall at all times be treated humanely without discrimination and shall be protected especially against all acts of violence to life and person. Since September 2000, close to 3,000 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli military forces. The great majority of those who have been killed have been civilians and therefore protected persons. The convention also prohibits the destruction by the occupying power of real or personal property, except where such destruction is rendered absolutely necessary by military operations to quote the conditioning in the convention. Between October 2000 and March 2004, at least 2,700 refugee homes in the Gaza Strip and 650 refugee shelters or homes in the West Bank have been demolished. In the Gaza Strip alone, these demolitions have affected and made homeless some 13,000 refugees. The agency has taken the view that these acts of destruction cannot reasonably be justified on grounds of military military security as asserted by the Israeli authorities. Israel, of course, has security problems. Israel has to deal with these security problems, and nobody could expect Israel to ignore them or leave its population at the will or at the risk of violence being perpetrated by the other side. But Israel, in pursuing these legitimate security aims, should respect the international legal framework in this. The convention further stipulates that the wounded and sick, as well as the infirm and expectant mothers, shall be the object of particular protection and respect, and that persons engaged in the operation and administration of civilian hospitals and in the search for removal and transporting of and caring for the wounded and sick civilians, including the infirm and maternity cases, shall be respected and protected. During the course of the current intifada, the restrictions on free movement imposed by the Israeli authorities have prevented many patients and medical staff from attending hospitals and health centers. On several occasions during the strife, UNRWA ambulances have been fired upon by the Israeli military, with at least five agency ambulance drivers injured and one agency staff member killed in an ambulance while assisting the injured. The convention provides that the occupying power is under an obligation to facilitate the proper working of all institutions devoted to the care and education of children. In the Gaza Strip alone, since the beginning of the current intifada in September 2000, 92 of the UNRWA pupils were killed and more than 1,100 injured, some of them sustained lasting disabilities. Another body of international law, you see there's no lack of bodies of law here, is of course the international human rights law, which has also played a role. In such places as Jordan, Lebanon, and the Syrian Arab Republic, agency interventions in education and health have always been framed within a rights-based context that finds its roots in, among other things, the International Bill of Rights. There are now moves afoot aimed at bringing the agency's shelter and housing interventions in line with a rights-based approach, particularly through the shelter rehabilitation and rehousing projects that we are currently carrying out in Gaza, the West Bank, and also in Syria. The General Assembly in December 1982 urged the Secretary General in consultation with UNRWA and pending the withdrawal of Israeli forces from the Palestinian and other Arab territories occupied since 1967 to undertake effective measures to guarantee the safety and security and the legal and human rights of the Palestinian refugees in the occupied territories. In the territories, human rights law continues to form a basis for agency interventions with the refugees and with respect to its relationship with the occupying power. The Palestinian civilian population in the territories has been long deprived of its human rights, including the fundamental rights to life and security of the person. While Israel, and I repeat, has legitimate security concerns, its measures against Palestinian violence during the current intifada appear not to have been balanced by sufficient concern for fundamental human rights, nor always guided by the principle of proportionality. Many of the operations and actions of the Palestinian militants have also not been consistent with fundamental respect for human rights. Protection of human life, the most fundamental human right, has been violated by both the Israeli military and the Palestinian militants. Since September 2000, more than 2,800 Palestinians and 800 Israelis have been killed, and approximately 28,000 Palestinians and 5,600 Israelis injured. More than 600 children have been killed, of whom around 500 were Palestinian and the rest Israeli. Continuing extrajudicial killings by the Israeli military and suicide bombings by Palestinian militants have only raised levels of frustration and anger, further complicating UNRWA's operations and service provisions. The final body of law I will refer to has to do with international refugee law, which has been much discussed lately because, surprisingly, the role of international refugee law is limited in UNRWA's operational environment. This is by virtue of the fact that the Palestine refugees are implicitly excluded from the benefits of the principal legal instrument governing treatment of refugees, the 1951 Convention relating to the status of refugees. Article 1D of the 1951 Convention provides that it shall not apply to persons who are at present receiving from organs or agencies of the United Nations other than the UNHCR for protection or assistance. When this article was drafted, the Palestine refugees were receiving protection from the United Nations Conciliation Commission for Palestine and assistance from UNRWA. Today, only UNRWA effectively continues to operate. Functionally, the UNHCR and UNRWA have operated according to an understanding that the 1951 convention may still apply to Palestine refugees who are outside UNRWA's area of operations, for instance, those seeking asylum in third-party states. This is based on Article 1D's so-called inclusion clause, by which the convention provides that when such protection or assistance ceases for any reason, without the position of the refugee being settled in accordance with relevant General Assembly resolutions, its provisions may ipso facto apply to that person. For its part, the agency has been vested by the General Assembly from time to time with a passive protection mandate, particularly during crises such as Sabra and Shatila, or the Intifada of 87 to 93, designed to offer a measure of passive protection for Palestine refugees in its area of operations. The agency is currently engaged in consultations with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, aimed at clarifying and addressing all aspects of the interpretation of Article 1D of the 1951 Convention. Last year, it was conveyed by Hans Corell to this gathering or in this forum that in order to ensure stability in international relations and assure legitimacy for actions taken by both states and international organizations alike, international law must be respected universally. I would suggest that from a practical standpoint, the extent to which UNRWA has resorted to public international law principles to define and shape its relations with stakeholders in its operational environment, particularly Israel and the host governments, serves as a cogent example of this proposition. For now more than 50 years, soon 55 years, UNRWA has used international law to implement its mandate and render essential services to the Palestine refugees. Four generations of Palestine refugees have directly benefited from the humanitarian interventions of the agency in the areas of education, health, relief, and social services, and other support mechanisms to make them self-reliant and give them a sustainable life. UNRWA's role has always been and continues to be temporary. The Palestine refugee problem remains unresolved, and until the parties to the conflict conclude an agreement that promises a just and durable solution to the plight of the refugees in accordance with principles of international law, I fear that peace will, as I said earlier, continue to elude us. As men and women who care deeply about the rule of law, universal human rights, and the role of the United Nations, has in upholding these important principles, we must continue to do our part in helping Israelis and Palestinians resolve their differences with due regard to international law. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you very much indeed. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Hansen has kindly agreed to answer questions. Could I ask you, please, if you'd like to ask a question, to raise your hand? Would you mind, when you're called on, telling us who you are before you ask your question? Please do that even if you are very famous and well-known, or if you think you are very famous and well-known, because that will at least enable people sitting behind you or in the gallery to know who's speaking. Thank you. Sir, if I can call on you first.
The famous Europeans, I mean famous Asian, so I don't know whether we are all famous for our famous things. This is the great British territory, if it is here, good time. I'm immensely pleased to listen to Mr. Peter Hansen, I mean one another, Hans Andersen from, I mean Hans, from Hans Andersen, Denmark. Thank you, sir, it was nice. I've got three issues. I'll be brief, sir, okay? Number one, about you rightly mentioned about the state-sponsored terrorism of the real shoulder-to-shoulder country, Israel. We all think that yeah, transparent and strong, we need a United Nations. What could you do? It was the Sheikh Hans, the paraplegic man, then the other day, my of course, your third world doctor, a pediatrician, RTC. I'm not talking about Yasser Arafat. What I'm talking about, Vananu, what could you do? We all think that, United Nations is such a great thing. What could you do if they assassinate him?
What would I do?
What could you do, or what could Kofi Annan do if this, the shoulder, the real protege of American, right, neocons, if they assassinate Vananu?
Thank you very much.
Number two is...
We'll just take one question, thank you very much. Yes,
okay.
Dr. Hansen.
Number two.
No, I'm sorry.
No.
There are several other people who would like to ask a question. We will take one question only. Thank you. One question only.
That is because it's a racist organization, okay?
Thank you.
Well, it is a quite hypothetical question, if I understood it correctly. I think what the Secretary General has done is to express his views in principle that... maybe the microphone is not on. Yes, it is. Okay. The Secretary General did and will undoubtedly do in other such cases speak about the principles through which the parties should deal with each other in such matters, and that does not include killing them by one way or the other. I would very strongly share that opinion and hope that people can sit down and talk and negotiate with each other rather than taking to such extrajudicial measures as assassinations.
Thank you. The gentleman at the back, just behind you with the microphone. Thank you. I'm sorry, sir. You really must let other people take part in the dialogue. It's not just for you. Thank you, sir.
My name is Najil Harazi. I am a journalist from Yemen, based in London. Thank you very much, Mr. Hansen. I have a question related to another international diplomat, who is Mr. Al-Akhdar Ibrahimi. When he described the situation in the Middle East, the General Secretary spokesman same day declined what Mr. Ibrahimi said, and said also that what Mr. Ibrahimi said was his own point of view, not the United Nations point of view. In this lecture, we heard you speaking frankly about the situation in the West Bank and Gaza. Are you sure that the Israeli government will not put pressure on you or on the United Nations not to say these facts again? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. A great deal of what I have said today, certainly with regard to the Fourth Geneva Convention, I said also at the meeting of the high contracting parties when they were considering the application of the convention to the occupation in Israel. I feel that what I have said is factual quotes from the convention and factual statements about what actually expires in the field, and I think that that is my duty, and it is the duty of my other colleagues who have responsibility in such situations to see them and tell them as best they can and as objectively in as balanced a way as is possible. Lakhdar Brahimi is a good and dear old friend. I don't know exactly how he was quoted, but I have, as I said, great respect for him, and cannot really imagine that he said anything that was out of order. I heard that the word poison was being used, and maybe I would not have used the same in describing it, but you can, with other words, say that the actions of Israel has not promoted the kind of political climate in the Middle East that is necessary to reach agreements, and the same goes for some of the Arab countries also. We have a great deal of things being said that don't contribute much to a meaningful communication about dealing with questions, and I could give you many examples, but I won't take the time to do that.
Thank you. The gentleman just back here. Thank you.
Jim Addington, Chair of Action of UN Renewal. My question is about the current international situation, not obviously just in Israel and Palestine. I hope this is more general, is acceptable. I believe that we're on a road which started in Kosovo, which was illegal, and went on to Afghanistan, where we attacked a country that wasn't mentioned in any resolution, and then, of course, the attack on Iraq. And what I'd like to ask is what you feel about the way in which we can restate international law, because my feeling is at the end of this road there will be no international law. And I can use one witness, if I may, and that is Prince Hassan of Jordan, who had a letter in the Telegraph last week, extremely alarming, in which he thinks we're on the verge of a third world war. And my feeling is that it wouldn't be too alarmist to see that in the long run, or perhaps medium run, if you like, Iraq will turn out to be the touchstone, the spark that sets that off.
Thank you very much. If I knew how to restate international law, I certainly would be extremely ambitious. I don't think there's any silver bullet that can do that. But I do think that rather than look at how international law has not been followed in all details of its letter, I think it is quite amazing to see the degree to which parties to international conflicts feel increasingly constrained and forced to address issues of international law through the international institutions. The role that the Security Council played in connection with the war in Iraq, I think, demonstrated a power of international law and legitimacy of international institutions and bodies that you would not have found in the 1950s and 1960s, where the UN was much more easily bypassed and where the Security Council was basically a debating chamber. There's, to my mind, no doubt about the fact that issues of law and issues of legitimacy has played an increasing and not a decreasing role. And the more we can test that before international bodies, the more we can, in the long run, strengthen it, hopefully. But there are more qualified international lawyers in this room than me. I'm just a poor political scientist, so I wouldn't propose to pronounce myself too firmly on that.
Well, this international law is certainly not going to contribute to that debate. The lady in the gallery up there, thank you. Sorry? Oh, I beg your pardon. I thought it was you with your hand up. The gentleman next to you.
My name is Jakob Lappin. I'm studying international history here at the LSE. My question there have been several allegations of UNRWA funding going directly towards Palestinian summer camps, which give paramilitary training and insightful education to Palestinian children. My question is, do you feel that this is a useful use of UN funds which will advance the cause of international law?
There has been exactly what you say, allegations, but there has not been a single finding by anybody who could document or give evidence to the effect that this has happened. There have been many, many allegations against UNRWA, and if you would look seriously at them, if you would take the evidence and weigh it and see the evidence that is not there, you will find that there is no basis to any of these allegations. we are, as we should be, under very close scrutiny by our donor countries, by member countries who are there in the region following everything we do. And they can attest too that this is simply fabrications that are made up by people who, for one reason or the other, wants to damage UNRWA. And I think it is so transparent that it doesn't really bother me, and I hope that you have not, for any reason, believed any of this without having seen a shred of evidence for it.
Thank you, Alison. The gentleman up there in the gallery. Thank you.
Thank you. Neville Grant, chair of the Blackheath and Greenwich United Nations Association, and I'm very glad I'm not a lawyer. My question is around equity in application of law. There was a panoply of sanctions applied against Iraq for breaches of numerous United Nations resolutions. And I have to admit that I was very much against these sanctions on humanitarian grounds. However, if they were to be applied to Iraq for numerous breaches, is it not the case that international law is thrown into extreme disrepute and disrespect if such sanctions are not equally applied in other circumstances, such as the consistent breach of international law by the State of Israel?
I think that is more a comment than it is a question, and I addressed it, fleetingly in my presentation. There is an increasing feeling among many that there are, as I said, double standards applied, and that applies particularly to the Middle East. These impressions or these perceptions don't come from absolutely nowhere.
Thank you. The lady in the red jumper there. Thank you.
Hi, Sarah Mallion, Communications Officer for Israel-Palestine Christian Aid. I wanted to ask if, now that Israel is going to be retaining the settlements in the West Bank with Bush's endorsement, if the two-state solution is now completely diminished, and if there's any hope for the roadmap anymore, mm-hmm. and whether you believe that a one-state solution is the way forward.
Thank you very much. I really don't believe much with regard to one or the other type of solution, but the two-state solution is the one that has been followed in authoritative UN decisions, roadmaps, and others, and I'm certainly not going to depart from that. However, I would share with you the impression I had from a conference recently of academics and scholars in Jerusalem. The one that I was asked to address, that reference was made to, I was astounded by the almost solid consensus that time not only is running away from a two-state solution, but has run away from a two-state solution. And many of these scholars, the vast majority of whom were Jewish from all over the world, were, to me, surprisingly reaching the same conclusion. If a two-state solution is going to be reached, there's no time to lose. And I feel that, I hope that whatever is going to happen with the withdrawal in Gaza will be a step, a first step in realizing these ideas, in using them as an opportunity and not seeing it as a last step in a process that will go no further. That would be really sad, and in my opinion, it would be very sad for Israel too to lose the moment for realizing a two-state solution that would be the best outcome from what a majority of Israelis who are living in the region and will continue to live in the region, what would be in it for them.
Thank you. Now, I have to say there have been several people who've been trying to catch my eye. I will get to as many of you as I can in the few minutes that are left. The gentleman at the front here, who was one of the first to put his hand up.
Hi, my name is Gal Alon. I'm a student at the LSE, a master student, and also I'm working for the IDF radio, the Israeli radio. And I want, first of all, to thank you for your unbiased speech here. Some comments and questions. First of all...
Well, I'm sorry, one question, please. And
okay, I will try to be as short as possible. I just want to make the things more unbiased. You didn't mention the first violation of the international law made in the Middle East. And I'm very sorry about that, because the first one was the decision of the Arab countries to ignore the decision of the partition plan and to try to seize Israel. And I think that if Israel will not win this war, I wouldn't be here. As Arafat said, I would be in the sea, not as a refugee anywhere. So after they rejected the partition plan, what happened with the right of return today is that if you will decide, if the United Nations will decide that all the Palestinian refugees have to come back to Israel, I, the third generation, for what happened 50 years ago, will have to lose my home. I want to ask you if you think it is a just solution, and I want to know if there is any, under international law, any case where the Palestinian refugees will come back to the Palestinian states. Of course, the Palestinian rejected the decision in Camp David, last comment, the decision in Camp David, the offer that was given in Camp David, and refused to accept a country. And again, I will be very happy to hear your comments about that.
Last comment. I think we'll have to leave it there because there are several.
I just didn't hear the word terror in his speech.
Well. Yes, Dr. Okay. Hansen.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the point you made. We can discuss the fate of Resolution 181 and the history around it for a very long time. The title for my speech was UNRWA's Operational Environment and the Role of International Law, and I stuck to that within the lifetime of UNRWA. But of course, UNRWA, as the UN, would recognize the right of the state of Israel to exist in peace and would not raise questions about that. But we would also like to see the rights of other people realized in a way that Israel can continue to live in peace. But 100 years of history, instead of going through just UNRWA's history, I think you would all have been lulled into sleep a long time ago, and I limited myself deliberately to UNRWA's history.
Thank you. Can I ask the gentleman in the front center here, please? Yes, sir.
Afif Safi, Palestinian representative in London. Dr. Hansen, my question to you is about Rafah and the Philadelphia corridor. First of all, very few people seem to be aware that the Gaza Strip is only 1.3% of mandatory Palestine. And yet Sharon, in multiple interviews, including one recently to Nahum Barnea and Yehudot Aharonot, said, we will be disengaging out of Gaza, but the Palestinians won't have the maritime water, airspace, no port, no airport. They won't handle borders with Egypt. We intend to enlarge the Philadelphia corridor. And he continued by saying, destroy more houses. The made homeless can go and settle in the evacuated settlements. All this might take 2 years of time, which would push any discussion of Palestinian statehood for many years further. My question to you, sir, what's happening in Rafah? What's the Philadelphia corridor? What's the size of the population of that city? How many houses have been demolished? The cordon sanitaire, which is being bulldozed, and where many foreigners besides Palestinians have died, including British, one a journalist and one a student. What's happening in Rafah? And what's the Philadelphia?
Thank you. All right.
I didn't interrupt you, by the way.
No. Thank you very much.
Well, I would not wish to pronounce myself on the details of the plan, because I think that what is happening in Rafah has been the destruction of many, many hundred houses, many, many people losing their homes, many people losing their livelihoods. Rafah is really, when you come there, 40 kilometers down Gaza, the end of the world. You cannot really get anywhere else, and you will not be able to get anywhere else unless the border between Egypt and Gaza would be open for the two countries to deal with the regime. I don't know whether that will happen or whether that can happen. I would expect Israel would wish to keep a very tight control over what enters and what exits from Gaza by air, sea, or road. And as long as that it will be so hermetically closed, it is very difficult to imagine Gaza as being anything of a viable polity or economy.
Thank you. I'm going to have time, I'm afraid, to take only two more questions. The lady in the gallery there and the lady down here who's been trying to intervene for a long time, about two rows from the back, the fair hair. Thank you. But first in the gallery, please.
A quick question. Erwin Harbottle, my name. Do you think that there's sufficient education in international law? Last year, Hans Corell commented that even among the great universities, the issue of international law was very inadequately addressed. Do you think this ought to go into schools so that we ought to know what we're talking about?
I'm sure any international lawyer will find that this discipline is not fairly covered by whatever institutions there are. But I do think, and in fact, many years ago in my secondary school curriculum in Denmark, there was a smattering of this, and I have myself written several textbooks that have been used in Danish curricula, and I hope that there would be just a bit of it in other schools too. I'm sure there would be in Sweden also, and in Norway. I don't know curricula from all over the world, but I definitely think that in a world that is becoming more and more integrated and hence more and more dependent and reliant on some functioning normative system, that should be given full recognition in the changing curriculum also, and what young people learn about in school.
I can't resist adding that in the LSE, more students are taking the undergraduate paper in international law this year than any other paper in the law department. Mm-hmm. The lady there.
Thank you. I'm Carrie Anderson, and I'm also a master's student at LSE. I'm wondering if, given the Israeli restrictions that you've mentioned, are you concerned that your agency might have to suspend more programs or possibly even terminate some or even potentially all of its programs for the Palestinian refugees?
Thank you. No, I don't envision that. There are organizations that have given up to operate in the occupied territories under the conditions we are exposed to. And I can see how difficult it is for the staff or for anybody to carry on. But we cannot just pull up and say to a refugee population that has depended on us for so many years, sorry, we are getting tired, we want to get out, and we'll leave you to your own devices. They have a legitimate expectation to expect the international community to support them, and I'm sure there will always be enough in the international community of staff who are willing to suffer life as it is there, and there will always be governments that are generous enough and fair and just enough to consider giving us the minimal finance we need to carry out the work.
I'm afraid there isn't going to be time to take any more questions, and I must apologize to those of you who've been trying to intervene. It's simply not been possible to take questions from everyone. I'd like to make a few comments by way of thanks. First of all, to the United Nations Association for organizing this lecture this evening and for sponsoring it, and also to the co-sponsors, the Bar Council International Relations Committee. May I also take this opportunity of thanking our stewards, who have done a wonderful job of getting round the room and trying to follow my half-baked directions about who I was trying to call on. And thank those of you in the audience who wanted to ask a question and didn't get the opportunity to do so for your considerable patience. But most of all, to ask you to join me in thanking our speaker this evening. I think we'll agree that we've had a great deal this evening by way of food for thought, food for agreement, and for some, food for disagreement in what's been said. There can't, I think, be any doubt that Dr. Hansen holds what is arguably one of the most difficult jobs in the United Nations, and certainly one of the most important. And we're very grateful indeed to you for giving up your time to come here and talk to us this evening and to give us such a stimulating presentation. Thank you very much indeed.